At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke's been at a big economic conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the past couple of days. He's done some hiking and river rafting, maybe, relaxed in the fresh mountain air. Us? All we got out of it was a lousy speech. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It's the 22nd of August today. Good to have you here. Of all the things to do on a late Friday in the summertime, digging into the details of the economy is probably not high on most people's lists. But that happens to be the Fed chairman's job, so Mr. Bernanke found himself up in Wyoming this week at an annual gathering of the economic best and brightest. In his speech today, he said he figures inflation's going to ease up over the next year or so. That'd be handy if it works out, because it would take a whole lot of pressure off him to raise interest rates. It's become something of a trend for Mr. Bernanke to use his Jackson Hole speech to set the economic mood. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When Ben Bernanke addressed the same crowd of central bankers and economists last year, as he put it, the financial storm had just reached gale force. It is not the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, he said, nor would it be appropriate to protect lenders and investors from the consequences of their financial decisions. Since then, of course, the Fed has essentially bailed out Bear Stearns, injected investment banks with emergency cash, and helped prop up mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Today, Bernanke spent much of his time defending the Fed's intervention. Economist John Makin was there. He says when circumstances changed, Bernanke changed his mind.
In effect, the chairman was saying to people who were criticizing the Fed's role, look, we faced a problem that could have severely jeopardized the global financial system, and so we had to act.
Today, Bernanke acknowledged the so-called moral hazard of government intervention. Susan Wachter teaches finance at the Wharton School. She says if investors and lenders believe the Fed will bail them out, they're likely to take even bigger risks.
The answer at this point has to be to rebuild the structure so that the risk of the behavior that led to the crisis is lessened.
In his speech, Bernanke laid out some quite technical ways to discourage excessive risk-taking. And now that the government has come to the rescue, he says regulators have to examine the whole financial system. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
John McCain and Barack Obama have spent the better part of the past couple of days beating each other up for being out of touch with the average American. It's a discussion centered on the real estate market. We all know housing's in serious trouble, but both men seem to be doing just fine for themselves there. McCain's got more houses than he can remember. Obama's house is worth $1.5 million. But if you really want out of touch, Marketplace's Steve Henn has the story for you.
No matter how many houses McCain or Obama own, they're both in the top 1% of American income earners. That means they're rich, right? Well, rich is relative. Robert Frank is the author of Richistan and blogs on wealth for the Wall Street Journal. Frank divides the wealthy into upper Richistan, which includes the McCains and anyone worth more than $100 million. Middle Richistan starts at about $10 million, and then come the merely affluent.
Which, in the world of Richistan, is the worst kind of pejorative insult you could ever call anybody.
The Obamas recently became affluent.
Yes, yes, but they're not McCains.
The Obamas earn a few million dollars a year, mostly in book royalties, and recently bought a stately Chicago home. But even McCain, with more houses than he can count, may feel pressure to keep up with the Joneses. Mario Correa hosts a TV pilot, Powerhouse. Think Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, set in Washington. It features homes like Surrey Hill, owned by Republican lobbyists Ed and Edwina Rogers.
It has an elevator, it has 8 refrigerators, it has so many rooms that she doesn't remember how many rooms she has in it, and it has a gift wrapping room where she likes to gift wrap gifts in money.
That's right, money. Edwina Rogers, a former advisor to the president, buys sheets of cash from the U.S. Mint, cuts them up, and uses them for wrapping paper.
Isn't it exciting? And I love giving gifts that are wrapped in U.S. dollars.
If the McCain's peers are wrapping up presents in sheets of money, it might make them feel really, well, just middle class. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Investors loved what the Fed chairman had to say today about inflation. That and falling oil helped cheer things along. We will have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. There are plenty of people out there who will tell you that in this digital age, newspapers aren't good for much of anything except fish wrap. But then you run across a story about actual fish. Today's New York Times has the tale of a couple of high school students in Manhattan who got curious about their sushi and whether they were actually getting the delicacies they had ordered. Katie Stokel took a lead from her scientist dad. She tried something called DNA barcoding, a way to genetically identify a species of, say, fish, that's simpler than sequencing the whole genome. Kate, good to talk to you.
Hi, good to talk to you, too.
Listen, it's not every high schooler who decides to DNA test their sushi. Where did this idea come from?
Well, my dad has been involved in barcoding for a long time, so I've sort of grown up listening to dinner table conversations about barcoding, so it's always been on my mind. And my friends and I love to go eat sushi, so we were wondering if you could apply the DNA barcoding technology to find out what fish we're eating.
So what exactly did you do?
So we would go to different restaurants and stores in New York City. We bought fish, and we snipped off a tiny little snippet of the sample. We stored them in alcohol vials, and then we sent them to a lab in Canada where they sequenced the DNA for us. And then when we got the results back, we found that a quarter of the samples were mislabeled.
What were some of the most egregious examples you found of this mislabeling?
Yeah, there were 9 samples labeled as red snapper, and 7 of them were not. And among those 7, 1 was actually the endangered species, Acadian redfish.
Well, that's not good. And what about the tuna example you found that I read about?
There was a white tuna. It was labeled as white tuna, and it was actually Mozambique tilapia, which is sort of a cheap farmed fish.
There's a little element of caveat emptor here. I mean, in a place as crazy for sushi as New York City, people are out there getting, you know, tilapia instead of tuna.
I know. You know, and I think one of the important things about this is consumers really should be getting what they pay for. So it's sort of like when people sell fake designer labels. You're paying the money for a brand, you should be getting that quality.
How much sushi did you buy, actually, for this experiment?
We bought about, I think it was $300 worth of fish.
Did you guys spend your own money, or did you spend dad's money?
Yeah, mostly. It was our hard-earned money. So, but it was it was over a long period of time.
Now, I understand that you're not interested in revealing exactly which restaurants are mislabeling their product for fear of lawsuits, but did you tell the restaurants that they were mislabeling?
No, we haven't spoken to them. You know, we're not even sure that the restaurants themselves are aware that they're selling mislabeled fish. So we don't really know where the mislabeling occurs. It's probably not the fishermen. and it may not even be the restaurant, so we're not sure yet.
Any inquiries from the New York City Department of Health or any of those guys? Consumer Affairs, has the mayor called you?
No, not yet.
All right, so this is a big science coup for you. You're on the front page of the New York Times. Are you going to be a scientist when you go off to school this fall to college?
You know, I'm not planning on it just yet. I think that's another interesting thing about the project is that I'm not a typical science student. You know, I'm interested in science, but I also like writing and psychology. So, you know, if someone like me can get involved in a project like this, it shows that other people can do it too. It's not just for the strictly science students.
Kate Stokel and her science experiment in New York City. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
British cyclist Chris Hoy is not getting the same kind of press as Michael Phelps or Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt, but he is right up there in the gold medal count along with him. Hoyt is the UK's first Olympic triple gold medalist in more than 100 years. Overall, the Brits have been having a pretty good time in Beijing. They're third in the total medal count. But now that the fun is almost over, the next Summer Games, London 2012, are starting to loom large. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports that when it comes to organizing and funding big events, the UK's track record isn't so great.
Since London won the right to stage the next Olympics, the estimated cost has quadrupled to $28 billion. The taxpayer will pick up most of the tab. Financial author David Craig is urging his fellow Brits to bail out now.
We've probably got about another 6 months to a year where we could stop the whole disaster, hand the games back to the International Olympic Committee, and maybe pay a few billion dollars in compensation, but we would still save $15-20 billion.
It isn't going to happen, of course. London is committed. Work on the huge new Olympic stadium is already well underway. But many Londoners are still fretting, and not only about the cost. Economist Andrew Hilton.
My heart sank when we won the right to stage the Olympics. I thought that it was a disaster for Britain. It would be immensely disruptive, no fun at all, and we'd screw it up.
A survey published just before the Beijing Games was equally negative. Only 15% of Brits thought the London Olympics would be good for the UK's international reputation. Out on the streets, I found plenty of doubts. Will the facilities be ready on time? Will the events go smoothly?
I can't see it. We can't organise anything, this country. I'm sorry. I mean, you've only just got to look round to see how organised we are. I'm not saying no more.
I'll tell you what, there's absolutely no chance in this. If they get that together, it'll be all in the last 6 months, and that they'll be scraping and scraping at it, because it's the only way the English know how to do things.
I pass the Olympic site every day, and I say to my wife, they're just moving mounds of earth about. And my wife says, why are you always so negative? So I just say I'm going by past experience.
All together now, 10, 9, 8.
Past experience of big British projects is not encouraging. Take the Millennium Celebration.
2, 1, 0.
A series of mishaps marred the event. Dignitaries stranded for hours at a remote railway station. The River of Fire, which sputtered and fizzled out in 3 seconds flat. And the Millennium Dome, a fiberglass tent which cost the British taxpayer $1 billion. And just this year, there's been the extraordinary debacle of Heathrow Airport's Terminal 5. London fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart says there's a simple explanation for Britain's long list of failures.
We're not very good at organising things.
Monty Python figured that out 40 years ago, portraying a country that struggled even to run a cheese shop.
Bell Paisley?
Sorry, sir.
Red Windsor?
Normally say yes. Today the van broke down.
Ah. Stilton?
Sorry.
Emmental? Gruyere?
No. Nope.
Gouda?
No.
Nope. Edam?
Nope.
But Danish planning expert Professor Bent Flubier says this is unfair. The Brits are no worse at running major projects than anyone else. They just revel in it when things go wrong.
The British are generally not afraid of studying what they're doing. I mean, digging up the problems, digging up the disasters. And of course, this means that there's more talk about this in the UK than in other countries.
Nevertheless, if bungling were an Olympic sport, Britain would probably take the gold. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. David, how are you this Friday?
I'm all right. You know, this whole week was sort of like reading a cliffhanger, not knowing whether they were all going to die in the end or not.
Nice.
Well, no. Seriously, I mean, you think about early. You go early on this week. We started off with that big Barron's article that was about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and it was like water torture. Those stocks fell 25% a day, and then those crazy Ruskies. It's just every day they're doing something, and in the back of my mind, I can hear that song. You know, back in the USSR.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this though. It seems to be that nobody was paying attention markets wise because things were going swimmingly the first 10 days that the Russians were in Georgia, and then all of a sudden, a couple of days ago, they woke up and said, "Oh my gosh, oil! It needs to go up right now."
Well, now the truth is, sometimes there is sort of a convenient excuse, and actually maybe that's a good example. I guess in a sense, sometimes the markets are bigger than the news. Take for example just this most recent action. You saw this enormous downdraft in oil, and probably to a greater degree you saw this strengthening in the dollar responsible for all these gyrations, and then everything corrected for a couple of 3 days, and they bought the euro back, and they, you know, bought the oil back and gold, and then now everything's gone back the other way. I think we're back to the trend. It looks like the dollar's going to be firmer and the metals are going to come down and oil prices are going to come down. And
all right, well, let me change gears on you here for a second and ask you about financials. We talked about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the banking sector. What about this news from Wall Street today about Lehman Brothers, that the Korean Development Bank is thinking about taking a chunk there?
Yeah, I don't know if that's really going to happen, if it's really them or whether that's just going to smoke out some other buyer. But we've got to have some resolution in this thing. I mean, back to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, earlier in the week I was saying just get a gun. You know, put them out of their misery. And in the case of Lehman, actually, a lot of the people are going around saying, you know, this is a pretty good deal. They've got this Neuberger Berman unit that manages money. And in essence, for what they're talking about getting for Lehman, you get Neuberger Berman, and then you get Lehman for free. They valued the whole thing at about this one unit. So maybe by this time Monday, you'll be talking about the resolution of that. Maybe that thing will be over.
Let me ask you, a lot of resolutions.
Yeah,
well, I was just going to say, speaking of resolution, will that bring us any closer to being out of this whole credit mess?
Oh, boy, I don't know. It just keeps cropping up. I had a fascinating discussion this week about these auction rate securities with a guy and with the company. And I said, how are you going to get out of these? Oh, well, we've got a great plan. And I said, what is that? He said, well, we're going to take the VRDPs, the variable rate demand preferreds, and we'll replace them with TOBs. I said, what's that? He said, it's a tender option bond. And then we've also got a LIR out there, and we've got some LPPs. What's an LPP? A liquidity protected preferred.
Oh, stop. Come on.
Yeah. It's like a shell game.
Oh, and see, that's how we got into this whole mess.
Yeah, it's true. Have a good weekend.
You too. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Man, they never stop. Coming up, staying afloat on canoe rentals.
Guess it'll be a full moon tonight, and that's the night to go downriver.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 197 points, 1.7% to end at 11,628. The NASDAQ rose 34 points, 1.4%, finished at 2414. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, 1.1%, closed at 1292. For the week, the Dow ended down 0.3%. The NASDAQ lost 1.5%. The S&P 500 slipped 0.5%. Lehman Brothers sprang up 5% on that KDB news that Johnson and I mentioned. Fannie Mae gained 3%, but its mortgage giant twin Freddie Mac bled another 11%. Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase each gained about 4% today. Prices on the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Clinton Global Initiative, convening world leaders from government, industry, and NGOs to commit to action on global challenges. ClintonGlobalInitiative.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
from the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for July. All eyes turn toward Denver for the 45th Democratic National Convention. And the annual Burning Man Festival gets underway in the Nevada desert. This year's theme is American Dream. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 3 years ago tomorrow, Tropical Depression 12 formed just southeast of the Bahamas. By the time what eventually became Hurricane Katrina dissolved over Canada 8 days later, the storm had become the worst natural disaster in American history. Huge parts of the Gulf Coast were inundated. Levee failures around New Orleans left most of that city underwater. We sent Marketplace's Tess Vigeland down to the Big Easy to find out how the recovery effort is progressing 3 years on, and she is back with us. Hiya, Tess.
Hi, Kai.
So tell us about this trip you took. Is the city back to what it used to be?
It's kind of hard for me to make that judgment. This was actually my first time ever in New Orleans. I'm sad to say I didn't see it pre-Katrina. But Kai, you know, it's hard for me to describe what it was like driving around all those neighborhoods we heard so much about after the storm, Gentilly, Mid-City, the Lower Ninth Ward. I wanted to come back with all these great stories of recovery and renewal because, you know, those are the stories that are going to keep bringing people back to New Orleans. But honestly, I returned wondering whether some of these neighborhoods are ever going to truly revive. The tourist zones, French Quarter, downtown, the casino, they're all well up and running. But out in the flood zone, you know, there's progress, but not nearly as much as I expected to see.
Well, what's going on? I mean, what's preventing anything from happening?
How much time do we have? Yeah. You know, these issues are unbelievably complex. I think first and foremost, people are still struggling with the decision to return to and rebuild their homes in a flood zone. In fact, this week, the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center issued some figures showing that 34% of the city's residential addresses are still empty lots. Hmm. Maybe there's a slab foundation there, but that's it. 65,000 pieces of empty property. And you can see that as you drive around. There are all these boarded up houses, these empty foundations. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you may have heard this other number that got quite a bit of play in the media. 70% of New Orleanians had returned. Hmm. Sounds great. Well, if you look deeper into that study, yes, they returned to higher ground, not to the flood zone. Places that have gas stations, grocery stores, post offices. And it's stunning to see how many neighborhoods 3 years later don't have those things.
Well, let's follow the money trail here for a second, Tess. I mean, the government's given billions of dollars in reconstruction aid. Why isn't it getting where it needs to be?
Yeah, $13 billion, in fact. And this is what gets people really angry about what's going on or not going on right now. You know, the Louisiana Road Home Program, this is the state agency that is funneling all these federal dollars to people. They've given out 116,000 grants worth an average of $58,000. Add that all up. $6 billion out of 13. So there are thousands upon thousands of people who are still waiting to get money to help them rebuild. And even with the money, there's a study out this week that says 83% of those recipients still didn't get enough to be able to finish completing their construction.
You've talked to the Road Home folks. What'd they say?
Well, first of all, there is a new administration in place. Governor Bobby Jindal, he appointed a new administrator for the Road Home program who says, look, I wasn't here when they created it. We're trying our best to fix it. Second, they are so afraid of Congress breathing down their neck and watching out for fraud in this program that is really keeping them from handing out money as quickly as they say they would like to. You know, they check and double check and triple check and quadruple check. Meantime, people are waiting and not rebuilding because they don't have the money to do it. And that's why these neighborhoods, so many of them, are empty.
Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. This weekend show, most of it anyway, is devoted to Tess's trip to New Orleans. We've got a slideshow of her trip on our website. It's marketplace.org. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
As you wind down the week, you're probably looking forward to a little R&R this weekend. Maybe it's something mellow like sitting on the back porch with a nice cold iced tea. But if you want to take it a step further, here's another installment of our series, Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
You know what would sound pretty good right about now? A nice relaxing float down a lazy river. An inner tube would do the trick, but a canoe might be even better. As these folks down on the banks of the Wisconsin River can attest, all you need are a couple of paddles and the wind at your back.
Hi, is there Lisa here?
How are you?
Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, the canoe lady.
Ruth the canoe lady.
Yeah. My name is Ruth Bender, and I rent canoes. Well, the folks had a boat, and the neighbors always came down here when I was young, and I just bought me 8 canoes and kept on growing. And I get a lot of repeat people. They're like family.
My name is Larry, and I'm going canoeing. And we're going to stop, and we're going to drink some beer and have fun. Can you take any one of these canoes, or...?
Yeah, that'll be fine. Okay, and then you can take this one here, too. Okay. These are heavy-duty aluminum canoes. They're tough. You can load a lot of things in there. They're 17 foot. Oh, you want to hear the tom-tom? You want to hear my Indian call? I was born and raised here. It's the home place. I've always been down at the riverside, and then I started a little business when my husband was in construction, and we're retired now. It's not a boring job. It is very challenging. New things happen almost every day. I enjoy it. The river's a little high for this time of the year, but there's a lot of nice sand islands for to camp on and picnic. We got coons along the river and deer. We got the bald eagles, and this is one of the favorite roosting places. I guess it'll be a full moon tonight, and that's the night to go downriver.
We're pretty excited. This is our first time going. And yeah, it's going to be a full moon tonight. It's going to be a beautiful night, great weather.
Be sure you got a life vest before you leave. And no glass on the river.
It's floating.
That's a good thing. Adios.
Brian Bull from Wisconsin Public Radio helped us out with that story. You can see Ruth Bender and her canoes on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a ray of sunshine for Floridians who've been dealing with the rains of Tropical Storm Fay for the past week or so. The wording there is important, tropical storm. Florida's insurance commissioner says because Fay never turned into a named hurricane, homeowners and businesses won't have to pay the sizable hurricane deductible most policies in the Sunshine State carry. So it's going to be just a regular flat amount instead of the hurricane payment, which is based on a percentage of total damage. So everybody's going to save a little bit of money there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 197 points, 1.7%. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 added 14 points. That is 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, we take you to Denver in the Democratic National Convention. The engineers of that city's light rail system are pretty proud of themselves.
Hooray, T-Rex, you're finally finished. How'd we ever build something so big? On budget and ahead of the schedule, let's tell the folks at Boston's Big Dig.
All righty then, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.